In this episode of the Irish People podcast, we're publishing a talk entitled The National Question in the Era of Imperial Decline by Alexander McKay of the Marx Engels Lenin Institute. The talk was recorded at a recent event organised by the Workers' Party in Trinity College, Dublin. You can find the Marx Engels Lenin Institute on YouTube, Twitter, Telegram, and their website, marxengelsinstitute.org.
Hello everyone, good evening. I present to you today, editor and political analyst of the Marx Engels Lenin Institute in Britain, and also a good member of our sister party, CPGBML.
Well done.
That's a mouthful. please, just CP or something. Anyway. So today our good comrade Alexander will be talking about the decline of imperialism and how that relates to the Irish situation in particular. But I mean generally this decline that's been taking place since around 2008. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it'll be a good talk.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation, comrades. Joining you from coming from the fair city of Manchester to join you today. And as Joshua indicated, going to be talking about the decline of the US-led imperialist system and the what might possibly replace it and how that decline is going to affect the national question, which of course affects the Irish national liberation struggle and also other struggles across the world that have been severely impacted over the last 3 to 4 decades by the end of the Soviet Union and the unprecedented dominance of the United States and its global order. So I'll begin by just giving a brief overview of what that last 30 years has actually been in terms of its development. So we will all be familiar, of course, with the way in which the Soviet Union, the people's democracies, decayed and declined and then collapsed in 1989 to 91. But it is, of course, for those of us like myself who actually live in an imperialist country without real study of the situation, it is sometimes hard to tell how the national question was actually impacted by all of this. And so when looking at the question of the ongoing national liberation struggles, it's important to bear in mind what Kwame Nkrumah first identified as the neo-colonial system that is operated principally by the United States and also by its allies in Europe, the former colonial powers being Britain, France, to a certain extent Italy, Spain, etc. as well. And I mention this in light of the recent developments in the Sahel, where the French neo-colonial system has been severely impacted by a series of nationalist-led military coups, which have brought in what I would argue are relatively progressive military regimes, which are seeking to establish a more authentic national independence from the flag independence that was left to them in the period of immediate decolonization. So the decay of neo-colonialism in sub-Saharan Africa, the ongoing battle for sovereignty and independence of the nations and the peoples of the Middle East or West Asia, depending upon which terminology one wants to use, is all, of course, revolving around, at the moment, the question of what is going on in what was east of Ukraine, now claimed as Western Russia. And it's the argument that I will make that the beginning of what is termed, in the Russian language anyway, the special military operation, marked a decisive departure point from the history of the last 30 years and sets us on the road to a new period in which, of course, new struggles will emerge. So to briefly look at the previous 30 years since the end of the official socialist period. So we have the collapse in 91. We then have an unprecedented period of US dominance, which is pretty much personified by two things, which is the beginning of it is arguably the Operation Desert Storm and the war in Iraq, and then into the 90s and the wars on what was Yugoslavia. But then you have the unprecedented US and British rampage around the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And this was seen by the US imperial planners as their decades of triumph, as they did call it. They had a project for a new American century. And this was supposed to be in the form of course, their operations across the Middle East, their occupation of the key oil-producing areas, the long list of countries that they had for regime change operations to be run on, which, of course, was essentially a product of the fact that all the countries that used to sit between the Soviet bloc and the U.S. imperialist bloc were now subject to unprecedented pressure. Either they were going to come into the U.S. bloc completely and allow a full U.S. control, a U.S. bloc control over their certainly their economic and trade policies, but they were going to be targeted if they didn't agree to that, which is why, of course, even characters who tried to cooperate with them, like Milosevic in Serbia, or Saddam Hussein himself, who tried to build some kind of relationship, and indeed had one, with the US, was deemed to be too independent. Why Gaddafi in Libya was deemed to be too much of an independent government that he was ultimately running, even after he'd done deals with the British and the Americans. And also why Assad in Syria was targeted. None of these characters are what you might call exactly revolutionary figures, particularly in the period where the US targeted them. But they were targeted because they stood slightly outside of the global imperialist system that the US was trying to build. And that is why they had the wars and sanctions campaigns unleashed upon them that were indeed put in place. So the period 91 to around about 2008 represents a period where the US feels, and indeed to a certain extent can, do anything it likes in the international sphere. They, of course, using the justification of 9/11, unleashed this rampage across the Middle East. And I won't go into all the grisly details, but we all, of course, will be aware of the tremendous amount of destruction, the amount of people killed, the amount displaced. It was all, of course, in the service of the project for a new American century. The idea being that by controlling these key strategic areas, they would be able to exercise another century of unprecedented dominance. And that is coming to a grisly conclusion in the Middle East at the moment, I would argue. But I will come back to the Gaza question later on. But this starts to fall apart in 2008 when you get the massive and ultimately very devastating global financial crisis, which becomes a long depression throughout the imperialist world, triggered by, of course, an unprecedented crisis of overproduction, which had been triggered by a long-term plan to try and do two things at the same time on behalf of the capitalist classes of Britain and the United States and others in the Western bloc as well, which is to combine wage cuts and downward pressure on the living standards of the working class with, of course, the continual support for a consumer-based economy. And you can only stretch that elastic band so far before it snaps completely. So to underpin that, of course, they needed to, as long as they were continually expanding credit at home, but also engage in acts of imperialism overseas so that they could properly fund their endeavors. This all, of course, starts to fall apart. They try to keep things going from 2010, 2011 through to 2015, where we have a turning point where the Russian ruling class, having been, to use a rather crude term, kicked in the nuts for 15 years by the US imperialists, having, as Putin observed in his recent interview given to Tucker Carlson, tried to become part of the bourgeois world over and over again, only for the US to essentially say, no, you are to be a raw resource appendage and nothing else. We are not prepared to accept you on any terms except that we completely dominate you. You are not allowed to have nuclear weapons, you're not allowed to have an army that can actually do anything other than, you know, repress your own working class. You're not allowed to have anything. We have got to control all of your resources and they've got to be made available for the world market. Otherwise, it's too much for us. That's too much independence for us. So even, as Putin said, people who wanted desperately to join the bourgeois world were unable to do so. A similar case is true of the Chinese, who, of course, embarked upon market reforms back in the 1970s and came to a realization slowly over many, many years that there was no way that the US was going to accept them as a partner. They were prepared to, of course, profit from Chinese labor by exporting manufacturing jobs over there, as were the Europeans, but they weren't prepared to stop the endless campaign to fundamentally replace the Communist Party of China, to make sure it was replaced with something more pliable that wouldn't develop the Chinese economy in a way that could be considered threatening to US hegemony, especially when you see the US administration freaking out about the Chinese making inroads into high-tech production that's one of the big reasons why the US is continually having this meltdown over Chinese economic progress. You're fine if the Chinese had remained a source of cheap labor and didn't develop the capacity to actually challenge US and European capabilities in terms of high-tech production, then that we wouldn't be seeing as many tensions as we are now. That fundamentally what's happened is that the Chinese have moved beyond being a site of cheap labor provision for US and European corporations, and now they are producing machinery and technology that not only rivals the US, but arguably in some areas actually surpasses it. And so what we see now is a product of the ending of the arrangements that the US tried to put in place with its biggest rivals, or what became its biggest rivals. They wanted to have a sober Yeltsin in charge of Russia in order that they could keep it suppressed and keep firm control over its energy and rare metals sector. And they wanted somebody who would ultimately end the rule of the Communist Party of China in the People's Republic of China and move over to some more corrupt, maybe a Chinese sober Yeltsin type system that wouldn't develop that economy in a way that could challenge them. All of these things after 2008 start to fall apart for them, however. There's a move in the Chinese party back in the direction of a more assertive outlook. There's some changes to the way that the Chinese party manages itself and the way it trains its cadre and the relationship that it has with the masses that takes it back, not exactly in a cultural revolution direction, but certainly in the direction of rebuilding closer ties with the working class that had been, to a certain extent, lost in the Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao period. And if you read the collection of speeches by the Chinese leaders, particularly, of course, Xi Jinping, you can see that the concern that they have is that they had, to a certain extent, lost that connection with the masses during the 90s and 2000s, where they had a lot of economic growth, but they brought in a lot of capitalist problems along with the growth in the market sector that they now need to resolve. So what you see by 2015 is two things. First of all, there is a visible decay in the ability of US imperialism to exert itself over the world. They have resorted to, rather than direct invasions, which proved to be domestically unpopular in the end and costly in terms of the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war, they resorted to waging war by proxy. In terms of Libya, that involved bringing in many, many thousands of jihadist fighters, Salafists, who were paid for by the Saudis, by the Qataris, and by other Gulf states. And this included putting together a foreign legion, some of whom were Libyan exiles from my own fair city, one of whom ended up blowing up Manchester Arena when he returned home. But we can get into that if anyone's got questions about it later. The point is, though, that at each stage, though, where the imperialists have tried to exert themselves on the, in terms of building their new American century, or it should be more correctly identified as an American and sort of collective West century, they have shown only the fact that they are much weaker than they imagined themselves to be. They were unable to suppress the Iraqi resistance. They were unable to defeat the Taliban, ended up being humiliated there and chased out of the place. And they were still been unable, even at this stage, to reinstitute things inside the United States itself, like the draft system, which you would need, of course, if any of these senators were actually serious about running the flag at the poll, going all John Wayne and charging off into Ukraine to take on the Russians. And they can't do that precisely because the long hangover of the defeat in Vietnam is still there, not just in military terms, but also in social terms. It's the case now that both in the United States and in Britain, if they attempted to impose some kind of draft system, it would fall apart in a few days, certainly in my country. They can't do it anymore. There hasn't been a draft in Britain for 65 years, not since 1959 being the last batch that went in. And if they tried to do it now, practically nobody would show up. It's not just the fact that they have been defeated on numerous occasions in their attempts to carry out suppression campaigns to maintain their hold over different countries around the world. It's that the social connections and what you might call the old social contract that the ruling class used to pretend at least but to abide by has gone. Like in the British case, you have a society which has been largely deindustrialized, which is atomized to a great degree, and which the ruling class is now discovering when they're trying to tap into reserves of British patriotism just simply aren't there anymore. Not even with people who are, you might expect to heed the call, such as the more petty bourgeois layers. So this is why in the British press right now, you're having an extended series of freakouts from Tory MPs declaring that Generation Z hates Britain. What the hell are we going to do? My God, we're all finished. To which I say, okay, well, you want to leave. We'll just build something new on the ashes you leave behind. So the point I'm making here is that the what was supposed to be a period of unprecedented dominance for US imperialism has only revealed them and their key partners' actual weaknesses, an inability to suppress revolts and national resistance against their attempts to impose themselves on key strategic areas in the world, an inability to actually fight directly their key rivals. The whole purpose of the Ukraine war was that they were outsourcing European in particular, but also American, military capacity to Ukraine in order that they could score a win against the Russians without actually risking their own men. And this is something that, of course, the various US senators have admitted to directly and indirectly, which is that they, you saw the man himself, John Stewart, make his comeback the other day. I didn't watch it, I saw the YouTube clip, just to get that in before anybody accuses me of engaging in 2000s nostalgia. He was interviewing the editor of The Economist, whose name I will not try and pronounce. And she was saying, well, it's a great deal. We send weapons to Ukraine, they die fighting the Russians and they weaken the Russia, and we don't have to send any Americans to do it. It's a rather a startling admission when you see that this is an intellectual representative of a nation which claims to be the leading imperialist power in the world, saying basically, well, we can't send our own men anymore. We don't have the capacity to do it. We've got to basically hire other people to do the fighting and the dying in various horrible ways for us. And isn't that great that we've got the money to do it? And John Stewart, of course, nods along and goes, yes, yes, Trump's bad, isn't he? And the other point to make about this is that along with the fact that they can't exactly exert themselves anymore, they have increasing problems at home. It's sort of bringing back and reigniting various different problems which they thought they'd put to bed. They thought that the neo-colonial system, for instance, that they had in Africa was set in stone. When the French departed from, or at least physically and militarily in some cases, departed from their colonial possessions in West Africa 60 years ago, they left in place, of course, the CFA franc zone and various other methods of controlling the colonies that they had left, such as Mali, Niger, what became Burkina Faso. And for the longest time, it appeared as if this was working. They were extracting an awful lot of value out of this system and getting an awful lot of cheap resources from places like Niger, particularly uranium that they were using for their nuclear reactors and also gold from Mali. And the recent eruption over the last few years of nationalist military coups in those countries, partially inspired in the case of Burkina Faso by, of course, the legacy of Thomas Sankara, but also inspired by the idea that they could now move against the Europeans in a way that they couldn't in the past, move against the French in a way that they couldn't in the past, because these people have all observed the European powers weakening over the decades. If you look into the backgrounds of people like Chiani, the leader of the Nigerian coup, if you look into the background of the military guys in Mali, or Traore in Burkina Faso, you can see people who've gone through, a lot of the time, the French military system. So they know it very well. And the guy in Guinea went through the old military police training academy in France. So they know the European powers well, and they've observed them from the inside, and they've observed that they are weakening. And so you get re-emergent again a nationalist current in these places where the anti-colonial revolution started. It got to a certain point, but the European powers managed to suppress it, and they managed to suppress it by basically turning round to the newly independent states and saying, as apparently de Gaulle did to the Nigerians and the Malians, we'll give you independence, but basically you've still got to pay up, because if you don't, we'll burn the place down on our way out. I am paraphrasing because I can't speak French. But the deal offered there was essentially, you can have your flag, you can have the national anthem, you can even elect a government from time to time, maybe we'll even let it stay in power. But if you try and exert or assert any actual sovereignty in terms of national development, in terms of planning your economy, perhaps inspired by examples from the people's democracies or the old communist states, then that's it. We will remove you as the French did, as the British did, as the Americans have done in many different coups across Africa and Latin America and Southeast Asia. And of course, all the European powers who had colonial possessions are guilty of that in Africa. The British themselves, along with the CIA, removed Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana as soon as he started talking about neo-colonialism. So what we're seeing, though, is the fact that this happened is inextricably linked to the developments both in the Russian special military operation, which is every day it goes by is not only, of course, a bloody tragedy for those involved in it, but also is showing the impotence and the corruption and the debased nature of the imperialist states. It's not only that people are not fearing them as much anymore, it's that they're not even worthy of respect. People can see that they're sending wave after wave of Ukrainian men and now women into the meat grinder of the east of the country. And they're looking at the fact that the US has been unable to or unwilling to send its own men there, unable or unwilling to build up its own military, can't expand its own military industries anymore. The British case is even worse. British capitalism is so degenerate that they keep talking about a 5-year plan to recreate the British military industry. But the only plan is that the British government will give money to the private owners of the military industry, and the private owners will say that's very nice, and then 5 years later they'll ask for some more. It's a complete and utter failure on many different levels, but it's encouraging in terms of the subject at hand, which is the national sovereignty and the national question, because now you're seeing these places like in the Sahel exert themselves and be able to remove French military influence. They will be able to, I'm sure, it will be a more difficult job, but remove the American military presence there as well, ultimately, because that's ultimately who's the guarantor of this world order. And that, of course, then opens up other questions, such as if they are capable of pushing the anti-colonial revolution into its next stage after 60 years of being stuck in the neo-colonial stage, or what is the future when it comes to other particular struggles. And this, of course, brings up the question of, well, what is the future of the imperial bloc as a whole? And when I say imperial bloc, it's because the bloc of Western European and countries, North America, the United States, Canada, to a certain extent New Zealand and Australia as well, but then they're more supporting players in this. They were welded into one, not cohesive, but unified bloc post-World War II by the United States. The United States, of course, looked at in 1945 and saw that France, what became West Germany, Italy, etc., were all in ruins, and they needed to rebuild them or face a communist takeover of all of these places. So they needed to rebuild the British and the Western Europeans to the point where they could be imperial powers again to a certain degree, but being good capitalists themselves, they didn't want them to rebuild to a point where they could actually threaten the United States. There is a great Soviet cartoon from about 1950 which shows all the imperialist powers sat on bar stools around a table, shaking hands with each other in one hand and soaring through each other's chair legs with the other. And I think that's probably the best visual metaphor for the European Union that you could come up with, given that what has become of the European project, so to speak, now is essentially it is any idea of strategic autonomy, which is much talked about these days in multipolar theorist circles, has bitten the dust. Now all of the major European powers have been interlinked with the US imperialist system for so long that they can't think about breaking away from it. You get a lot of people saying, well, why does, for instance, Germany insist on committing industrial suicide? Why does it cut itself off from Russian cheap oil and gas? Well, the answer is because there's two reasons. Firstly, is that the German political elite, perhaps more even than the French, is completely beholden in security terms to US imperialism. But also, it's that they share a common interest now. And that common interest is in the ruining and the breaking up of the Russian Federation and the looting of its resources. That's a shared objective. So when people say, well, why do the Germans want to indulge in this war, a proxy war on Russia, and why don't they pull out of it even though they're being deindustrialized? Well, the truth is that they have long ago pinned their common interests to the American interest, and they have a shared interest in the ruining of both Russia and ultimately China. Bear in mind also that a lot of German businesses are relocating to China now, so they are further pushed down the route, I would argue, of confrontation with the Chinese as well. So the system that was built post-World War II that essentially welded the Europeans to the Americans, that a lot of people believe would come to an end and offer strategic autonomy for the European powers after 1991, that all turned out to be a series of illusions. It all fell apart after Well, I would argue the Eurozone debt crisis revealed just how weak a lot of the European economies were, how they were dominated by ultimately the Germans and the French, and ultimately the French and the Germans were dependent upon the US, certainly for military support. But to turn also to the other player in this, which is, of course, British imperialism. I would be remiss in my duties if I didn't cover extensively my own home nation. The British imperialism is, if anything, in an even worse state. The political leadership there have miscalculated repeatedly in recent years. I'm sure you're all familiar with the Brexit process, or the lack of process. The calling of that particular referendum, what that was really all about, was about a deep crisis within the ruling hierarchy of the British state itself, and a deep crisis within the ruling Conservative Party. The ruling Conservative Party has certain things in common this with the Trump movement in the United States. Been so successful for so long because it consists of course, the ruling class themselves, but lower bourgeois layers and upper petty bourgeois layers who are the foot soldiers, so to speak, and the rank and file of this party. For a long time, they, of course, were happy to vote for it and enthusiastically endorse attacks on the working class, all kinds of imperialism, you name it, they're out there waving the flag for it. But after the crash of 2008, even these layers started to notice that the system was starting to squeeze them, that they were losing money, that their businesses were being pushed towards bankruptcy. There are thousands and thousands of small businesses in Britain today which constantly hover on the edge of bankruptcy. With a slight increase in further increase in interest rates, we could see like a record amount of bankruptcies in Britain. We're already seeing quite a few year on year. And so this layer, these layers that had been enthusiastic supporters of the Conservative Party for an awful long time, are suddenly faced with the fact that British imperialism, of course, ultimately doesn't need them either. Yes, they need them for internal political stability and voting fodder, but they don't really need them for the where the big profits are, which are, of course, in hyper-exploiting what is generally referred to as the global south. So this is now represents a problem. It's a problem for the British ruling class in terms of stability, because they're now facing a situation where even the lower bourgeois and upper petty bourgeois are revolting to a certain degree in a sort of little England and nationalistic way against even their own ruling party now. This is now manifesting a severe political crisis, which is a reflection of a deep decay. We're the oldest continually existing capitalist nation in the world. There's an argument that the Republic of Venice got there before us, but Britain is certainly the oldest imperialist power. And this manifests itself in the fact that our crisis of imperialism is deeper even than the United States in some ways, because our capitalism became more financialized more quickly. The fact that we got deindustrialized at probably an even greater rate than the United States. We've barely got a steel industry anymore. All this grand talk from the politicians now about a five-year plan to regenerate industry. Well, that's great. In 5 years, we'll have the square root of zero, which is zero, unless my maths is really wrong. And the sheer degeneracy and rotten decay of British capitalism means that essentially the political class now doesn't know what to do. They're running because their entire business model since probably the 90s and the end point of deindustrialization was to make sure that they kept their big companies in the top 200 list. They kept being able to extract wealth from as many different places in the world as possible and bring it back to Britain again. That's now being challenged. Everybody's seeing that the US has been weakened. Everybody's seeing that they can't realistically hope to beat the Russians in Ukraine. And of course, the British, since 1956, since the Suez Crisis, have clung to the Americans like a drowning man clams onto a life raft. And without the American dominance, then the British imperialism is finished. It has no ability to sustain itself except as a junior partner to the United States. I read that Boris Johnson's, he didn't write it, of course, his amazing national security strategy and Britain's presence in the world strategy. And it basically amounted to that Britain is very good at three things. One, specialist weapons systems. Well, that doesn't look so good anymore. Two is branding. Very good at branding, very good at selling things. We're very good at calling a giant pile of bullshit gold. And the other thing is, of course, selling our legacy, selling the historic, what you might call in Marxian terms, the cultural capital of Britain. It actually used to be my job. Many years ago, I worked for an institution that's called the British Council. Some of you may have come across it. And my job was to sell Britain to foreign students, especially. If I lied to any of you, I apologize. The idea was that we were selling this image of Britain, that we were particularly selling it to the Chinese, to the people in the Middle East. Egypt was a big target country. Tunisia was a big target country. The idea being that we take the elite from these countries, bring them to Britain, we work them into ruling class networks, give them a grand old British education, and send them home. With the idea being that in 10 to 20 years' time, these people will be in high office somewhere, and they can give us an arms deal or an oil contract or something like that. And that's what they mean by trading on the legacy of Britain. It's not a real thing anymore. It's what people think Britain was based on the history. But of course, once you get there, you realize that it's very much not real. But all of that falls apart if the image goes, and the image is going. Not just for those who actually go there, but if you see then that the great British Navy doesn't really exist anymore, that the Yemenis can scare it away with a rocket launcher or two, if you see that the British Army basically couldn't fill a football stadium, if you see that the Air Force can't exist without slapping a puncture repair kit out whilst in flight, then it doesn't look particularly scary anymore. It's all just image. It's all historical legacy. Marx observed that capitalism was based on dead labor, sucking like a vampire from the living. Well, Britain is based on the dead labor of generations and the dead labor of many exploited countries all over the world. And that dead labor is now running out. We accumulated a gigantic amount of capital through our exploitation of many different colonies, all from close to home to further away. That the ability to do that is coming to a close. If these countries turn around and say to Britain or France or Germany, well, no, we're not going to engage in these neo-colonial terms of trade with you anymore, well, then Britain and France and Germany have to either fundamentally change their mode of doing business or face severe economic decline. And severe economic decline is what is facing us. But to turn out, how long do I have left, just out of curiosity?
Oh, you still got
that. Okay. Okay, so we haven't even gotten to Britain and Ireland yet. So, the question, of course, British imperialism, of course, then takes us to the national question with relation to Ireland and the continual occupation of the six counties in the north and what the future holds there. I will offer some comments on this because I think it's important to emphasise that even though that we communists in Britain are critical of the programme of Sinn Féin, particularly in relation to its more positive views of US imperialism these days, and its, of course, enthusiastic embrace of the European Union, even on the basis of what I would call the limited programme that they offer, if Ireland was to be reunified on that basis, it would still mark a tremendously progressive event. It would mark a further weakening of British imperialism. It would be a further blow to British imperialism's ability to project itself as the powerful thing that it once was. It has been chased out of its own backyard, even if a unified Irish government had to sign a million different concessions in order to finally get that unification. But of course, I'm sure everybody here knows and understands that even if unity was achieved on that limited basis, then it would still be a step forward because it would be a step into another struggle immediately afterwards, given what many of us in Britain view as the rather, shall we say, limited nature of the Irish capitalist class and their ability to engage in a nation-building project. For us, in terms of us being communist in Britain, the end of the British imperial system can only be a good thing. Because, of course, what many people, including social democrats across Europe and even across the rest of the world, see as the admirable things about Britain, our national health service, the wider welfare state, etc., it's incumbent upon communists in Britain to be honest with people and say how this was paid for. How was it paid for? Well, brutally speaking, the Attlee government post-1945 paid for this by the hyper-exploitation of the colonial system, of the colonized peoples. Don't take my word for it. Take the words of the men who were in the cabinets at the time. It's all written down by now. There's a particularly good book on this by a former city trader, it's called The City by Tony Norfield. In the first chapter, he outlines quite clearly how the Labour government of 45 to 51 saw its way to fund the welfare state settlement. It was funded by ripping off the Malaysians, particularly. That's what lay behind the violent, very violent, brutal suppression campaign against the Malayan communists in the 40s and the 50s, by ripping off places like Kenya, which of course stoked the independence movement there. This is how the social democratic concessions in Britain were paid for, that and loans from the Americans. It wasn't just done because Clement Attlee woke up one day and decided, you know what, I'm going to bring in socialism. He had no intention of doing so. What happened was they looked at the situation after World War II in Britain, realized that if they didn't make a series of concessions, that it would be risking revolution due to the strength of the working class and also the inspiration given to them by the triumph of the Soviet Union. That without serious concessions, that it would be all over. And the serious concessions were paid for by a brutish campaign of forced extraction of what you call super profits across the imperial possessions. Same is true for France, and certainly true for how the US ultimately paid for its concessions as well. So we need to be a little bit honest about our system, which is why, of course, many of us have no time for the social democratic experiments in Britain anymore. And I was a part for a little while of the Corbyn project, but part of the reason I left it was because the Labour Party, even the Labour left, refuses to reckon with the legacy of British imperialism. They just can't square it, because their entire inspiration is that period, 45 to 51. We did it then, we can do it again. They don't want to ask the question, well, how could we do it then? How could we pay for it? Well, the answer is ripping off about a third of the world at gunpoint. And if you can't do that, then you can't make concessions at home anymore. And if you're imperialist, if you're perceived as weak, and if you're not able to intimidate people into negative trade deals anymore, if you're not able to have Rio Tinto go around the world and extract rare earth metals at the point of a gun, then, well, British imperialism's ability to continue to offer what little concessions it still does, domestically speaking, is over. And again, so when looking at the forcing back of British imperialism anywhere in the world, any communist in Britain should welcome that. It is unfortunate that some people who call themselves communists still try to indulge the fantasy that we can return to social democracy in Britain. My argument would be that that is neither possible nor desirable. Now it is a case of we have to reckon with the utterly parasitic British ruling class, and we have to do so in a way that will remove their power once and for all. Because the thing about the imperialist system, not only is it rapacious and it destroys many areas of the world, hyper-exploits many peoples, and this is true for all of the imperialist powers, but ultimately the ruling class would rather burn down their own country rather than see the working class have a bit more influence within it. During the Jeremy Corbyn era, when we had the most mild of social democracies on offer, so to speak, there were talks of military coups and all kinds of things coming from generals in Whitehall, the kind of men who still dream of mowing down peasants in the subcontinent. They're perfectly prepared to do it to people in Britain. They regard the British working class as lower than the low. So what needs to be done is an honest reckoning with that. And I think the way in which the things have developed in certainly my own country since the crash of 2008, and arguably much longer, is that the working class has seen its standard of living diminish. We've seen the concessions that have been made to them over the years almost be all withdrawn now. The National Health Service is still there, but it's getting sold off bit by bit by bit to various American healthcare corporations. And the election this year, of course, offers absolutely no change. The weaker that we can make the British government, the better, to be completely honest about it. And I know that might sound a little on the accelerationist side, but really, it's a realistic view in my analysis. So to turn to the question then of moving beyond British imperialism to the coming multipolar system, and what does that mean? There are some who believe that the US will be prepared, ultimately, having seen the fact that it is being pushed back and defeated in Ukraine, that it stands no real chance of uprooting the Communist Party of China or destroying the PRC, that it will be prepared to see some sort of new Westphalian system of states enter the world, while it will do bargains with the Russians and the Chinese, and everybody will get along with each other. And the Americans will just get over being an imperialist power the way one might get over smoking or a particularly bad drinking habit. This is, of course, a futile delusion, because you can't get over imperialism. Because what people don't want to realize, and this is particularly true of analysts within the United States, of the so-called realist school, is that what you have is a frantic denial that they are an imperialist power. It's no news to me. There's been people in Britain who've denied that we're an imperialist power for about 400 years. If you read something, just to give a historical example of the old book, The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, which is a sort of classic of the British trade union and working class literature, there's an argument between the characters who were all builders in the early part of the book, saying that one is saying, we don't need this empire, it's too expensive, it's bringing in too many immigrants and too little money for us, we need protectionism, we need to vote for the Tories. And then the other guy says, no, wealth is being brought in by free trade, we need to vote for the Liberals, and that's written in 1901. So again, like, there's always been this denial that an imperialist power is an imperialist power, and that is true in the United States as well. There are many in the United States who want to see themselves as the glorious Republic of Jefferson still, whereas of course that is long gone. It's an imperialist power now, and not only that, but the profits of its ruling class are overwhelmingly coming now, much more from outside the United States than from within it. And so reckoning with that is a very difficult thing to do, given that it's not just about a political reckoning, it's about an economic reckoning. And you can't just turn over a new leaf and stop being an imperialist power. It would be tremendously destructive for the profits of the leading US monopolies, just as it will be, destructive for the profits of the leading British monopolies to stop being an imperialist power. My point is, not to be too negative about this, but that they can't just turn over a new leaf. It's not a matter of making a New Year's resolution. Imperialism is ingrained in the British ruling class. It's ingrained in the American ruling class. To actually remove it and uproot it will take struggles, not just in the colonized nations and amongst the oppressed peoples of the world. It will take us, as those who are residents and who are workers in the imperialist countries, reckoning with the history, as I've just gone into, but also then being able to wage a class struggle on an honest basis, not pretending that we can go back to social democracy, because we can't, and actually being able to wage that struggle in a way that actually says to the working class, no, our job is not to go back. And as a communist, I find the idea that social democracy is something to be got back to be rather repulsive, because yes, it made some certain improvements back in the day, but we as communists do not want to hand the working class something. We do not want to hand them a welfare state. We as communists see the working class as the future ruling class. And that is the way we must conduct ourselves on a day-to-day basis. I do not aspire to be a bureaucrat handing out charity. I aspire to play my part in the overturn of British capitalism, of British imperialism, to have those who are regarded as being at the bottom of society now raise themselves to the point where they can play a full and active part in the redevelopment and the rebirth of the British nation. Not to get too romantic about it, but the old East German anthem of the German Democratic Republic had some rather great lyrics in it, which perhaps it would be apt to end this particular section of the presentation on, where, I won't do the German, but it basically broadly translated as building out of the ruins. That is the theme which the song returns to over and over again. And that I find particularly inspirational when you're looking at the story of the old German Democratic Republic, reckoning with the gargantuan crimes of the Nazi regime by building a system that was genuinely internationalist and aided the struggle for the liberation of oppressed peoples. Well, that is how we in the imperialist countries must view it. We must, as the working class, overcome the imperialist system, not seek to reconstitute it, and rebuild a country that actually answers the sins of its past by helping and aiding, in a genuine sense of internationalist solidarity, those who are struggling still against the imperialist system of the present. That is how you redeem a country that is as soaked in blood as the British ruling class have made ours over the years. And so I'll conclude, comrades, on this particular point. The last 30 years have been one that was meant to establish the dominance of the US imperial system, the unipolar system, in perpetuity, or at least for another 100 years. That ran aground almost immediately as the long-term weaknesses of American imperialism got exposed in the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. The vicious proxy wars that they tried to wage afterwards have all led to a bloody failure. And now they are getting desperate, and they have attempted to overthrow and destroy the Russian Federation, just as they were attempting to do so with the Chinese, but doing so in the most cowardly and mendacious fashion possible, again, using other peoples to do so. We are visibly coming to the end of this particular era, and that is something that is providing us with enormous problems, given that we are coming out of a long period of the atomization of the working class in imperialist countries and the suppression of working class organization. But it opens up great new fields of struggle for us, and it is not going to be an easy process to reach the building out of the ruins I have just been talking about, but it's a process that we must embrace, not look back perpetually with Labour Party tinted glasses to a glorious past that wasn't always that glorious. So to conclude my contribution for this evening, we come out of a failed ruling class utopia. Francis Fukuyama's End of History was meant to be the utopia of the American system. It was a dystopia for many, many millions across the world. And as we fall out of their utopia, you can see them, the ruling class, that is, becoming ever more wild and maddened as everything they thought they had secured falls apart around them. Again, this presents new avenues of struggle for us, and it should inspire us to rebuild the communist movements in all of our countries, and for those of us in the imperialist countries to wage an unremitting struggle against the remnants of the imperialist system and be prepared to support all struggles, however small they might be, however small the advance might be, in support of those seeking to resolve the national question, seeking to throw off neo-colonialism and genuinely assert independence, because that is the strength of ours. It strengthens our struggle as well. As both Lenin and Stalin pointed out a long time ago, the true ally of the working classes of the imperialist countries is not their own ruling class, it's not our beloved labor aristocracy. It is the oppressed peoples and the colonized peoples all over the world. It is with them that we must unify, and it is with that sentiment that I will conclude my remarks today. Thank you. How are we time-wise?
I think we're good on time. So do you want to take questions then?
Yes, certainly can. Any questions, contributions, etc.?
In relation to the Gaza situation and the ruling class, do you think, in a strange way, what's happened in Gaza now is going to expose the ruling class what's been holding the air as well?
Yeah, I mean, the Gaza situation I didn't get to, but I will gladly answer that question now, comrade. Of course, Britain, again, bears a special responsibility for the catastrophe in Gaza. The British imperialists created the Zionist entity. We did so, in the words of one former colonial official, to create, direct quote now, a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of hostile Arabism. That was the remark of a guy called Sir Ronald Storrs, who was the first military governor of occupied Palestine. And we used the Zionist movement in the same way we sought to use various different religious minorities in India, the way in which we used the what the people referred to as the loyalists in the north of Ireland, to find a minority group, elevate it to the status of a ruling group, and then have it brutalize the surrounding population to make sure that the lands around it remain forever divided. So there is a special responsibility with regard to the British ruling class. To your point about why they refuse to stop the genocide that's going on now, though, to address that, well, they refuse to stop it because, to be rather blunt about it, the genocide is in their interests. They are prepared to defend Israel as long as they are and in as brutal a fashion as possible, because if they lose Israel, that is it for Britain and the United States in the Middle East. Israel is the unsinkable aircraft carrier. It's still performing the role that people like Ronald Storrs and the other colonial administrators and people like Balfour designed for the Zionist movement to play in the Middle East all those years ago. It's now playing it mainly for the Americans. But were it not for the existence of Israel, if we think back to the role that it has performed for imperialism over the years, the Six-Day War, for instance, in 1967, has been proven in recent years to be all based on complete lies. There was no genius NASA-inspired plan to actually attack. It was all made up to justify a strike on particularly Ba'athist Syria and Nasserist Egypt. Because why? They didn't want a man with the great prestige that Gamal Abdel Nasser had being able to lead a struggle for Arab unity. And so what do you do? Well, we used Israel in 1956 to attack Egypt, and then the Americans and the British and the French used Israel again to attack the surrounding countries who were in favor of Arab unity in 1967. And the same is true now. Right? There's a reason why Biden, well, maybe not Biden, but there's a reason why his handlers and the British government refused to do anything to even restrain the Israelis. It's because the slaughter is being conducted for the sake of the preservation of the state of Israel. If Netanyahu stops, or any Israeli prime minister, but particularly Netanyahu, then he is finished. And it's not just the fact that he is finished, but that the entire Israeli political class will face a deep, deep crisis that they cannot possibly recover from. So the resistance in Gaza, the military operation launched by the Palestinian National Liberation Forces on October the 7th, forced out into the open the role that Israel plays and the reason why the American and the British imperialists will not abandon it is precisely for those reasons. It is a colonial expression of Britain and the United States. And if that means that another 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, God knows how many, are killed in Gaza and elsewhere, then the British and American governments will continue to approve of it. Now, I don't say that just to be melodramatic. Well, look at their track record. If we just examine as long as they can hide the slaughter in terms of the slaughter in the defense of their interests, they will try and do so. All the American government is interested in is making it look as if they're doing something. In reality, they're just telling the Israelis to carry on. That's why they're supplying thousands of tons of high explosive bombs, lots of shells, lots of spare parts for the aircraft. We've got Israeli aircraft flying into British air bases to get repaired and restocked in terms of their ammunition. This was tracked by declassified UK recently. So we're running this war, Britain and the United States. There's no doubt about that. And it's a war that's in defense of the imperialist interests of both countries. And that our job inside the imperialist countries is to expose that and explain it properly. It's not just that Netanyahu's a bad psychotic guy, even though he is. It's not just that he's in allegiance, political alliance with fascists, even though he is. He's an agent of British and US imperialism. Every Israeli prime minister has been. And so to oppose the war means to oppose the British and the American presence in the Middle East. And Hassan Nasrallah, the general secretary of Hezbollah, has expressed it quite well, which he says, Gaza is the epicenter of the struggle right now, but it's a region-wide struggle, not just against Israel, but against the continuing influence of US imperialism. To remove US imperialism, not just from Syria and Iraq, but from all the countries in the Middle East, will take, as Nasrallah correctly said, a long and sometimes very costly struggle. And I always say when we're examining the colonial wars to remove an imperialist power from somewhere it really doesn't want to leave, just look at what the French did in Algeria. They killed 1 million people before they were forced out of there. I mean, look at the brutalities that the British committed in Kenya, forcing tens of thousands of people into essentially like open-air prison camps, killing many, many thousands, starving people, brutalizing people. This is what imperialist powers do when they're forced out of countries that they are desperate to hang on to. Franz Fanon in Wretched of the Earth gives examples of how the French behaved in Algeria. They killed 40,000 people inside a month in 1945 when World War II was still going on. This is at the time that everybody's saying, Vive la France, Vive de Gaulle, damn those Nazis. Well, they're engaging in Nazi-type behavior in their own colonies. So this is a long track record. And so when looking at the crimes of empire, we need to bear that in mind. But there's an opportunity here to finish on your question, comrade, which is that more and more people, especially of the younger generations, are now waking up for the first time and seeing these countries for what they are, which is that it's not just Netanyahu's crimes, it's not just Ben-Gvir and Smotrich being lunatics, and that it's that this is Biden's crime, and it would be any US president's crime. It doesn't matter if you brought in Trump tomorrow, he'd be even more enthusiastic about it. It doesn't matter if you brought in Keir Starmer tomorrow, he'd be even more enthusiastic about it, because these are all dedicated servants of imperialism. And that is the reality. And the more people we can talk to about that and get to realize that this is the nature of the system we live under, the better. And in the end, it's going to be down to how much pressure can be exerted on the imperialist governments. But also, ultimately, it's going to have to be a defeat of the Israeli military itself and the plunging of Israeli society into a crisis. Because you cannot have, in my view, a two-state solution anymore. That's dead. Israel and the US killed it. If there was any chance for it, it died in about 1999. So it's, again, like this is the brutality of a system which is on the way out. There will be, I'm sure, liberation for Palestine, but not without, unfortunately, more sacrifice on behalf of the people who have already had to sacrifice so much in the cause of their own liberation. I wish I had a more cheerful answer to give you, comrade, but it's a harsh struggle that they are in. I disagree with your point of view that it was accelerationist, comrade, if you will permit me to explain why. The winter of discontent is portrayed that way a lot in popular media. What was actually going on in the Wilson-Callaghan years, though, was the high point of working class combined struggle was 72 to 74 in Britain. It was the two national miners' strikes that have been led from the bottom up by rank-and-file organizers, including Arthur Scargill. And there was a real unity of the working class in around about 74. You had power workers walking out in support of miners. You had car workers walking out in support of miners. You had engineers working out in support of miners. It was a gigantic nationwide expression of the unity of the working class. What happens in 74 to 79 is that in actual fact, the Labour Party comes in to play its traditional role, which is that the ruling class, the British ruling class, aren't stupid, or they weren't back then. They could see that if the working class remained united in taking action, that it would be severe problems for them. So they set the Labour Party to work in dividing that movement up. They did so by instituting new regimes of pay in the nationalised industries to make sure that there were as many bacon slice-like divisions in the working class as possible. So, like, I'll use the mines as an example. The reason why you got so much scabbing in 1984 was because they put different regions of men on different bonus systems. Nottinghamshire, which was the big region that stayed working in 84, 25, had been given huge bonuses for having extra productive coal pits in the late 70s by the Labour government. So they were buying off different layers of the working class. The winter of discontent, to come to your question, was mainly public sector, lower paid, often women workers, many of the times in actual fact from migrant backgrounds, who had been working in local council service, who'd been chronically underpaid for decades. And their strikes were inspired by the earlier strikes in the 1970s, and they were driven from the ground upward. So the way it's portrayed in Britain is that it was the trade union barons, as they're always described. Now, there are trade union barons in Britain. It's the ones who sold out and got given a seat in the House of Lords. But it was the workers themselves in local government who drove those struggles. What the Labour government was successful at is making sure that the big dangerous areas of the working class, so engineering, transportation, chemical industries, to a certain extent the car industry, but there were a lot of problems there, didn't go into joint struggle with these local government and public sector workers who were driving the winter of discontent, as it is called. So I wouldn't say that it was an accelerationist struggle back then, comrade, to answer your point. I would say that this was a struggle waged by groups of workers who had been chronically underpaid for many, many years. The problem was that those struggles all took place cut off from the more, shall we say, what you could call the productive working class, the private sector, the engineering, the production line workers. They were all kept divided and away from the movement. So the reason why we get a gigantic failure in the early 80s is a manifestation of the role that the Labour Party had played in the late 70s in dividing up the lower paid public sector from the higher paid private sector, dividing the nationalised industry workers, even amongst different grades, so that by the time we get the assault launched by Thatcher, the working class is already divided into many, many different groupings based on sector of industry, based on income level, based on bonus payments they receive. So the Labour Party set up the pins and then Thatcher knocked them down, would be the way I would respond to that. I don't think it was an accelerationist struggle. I think it was, unfortunately, a struggle that was ultimately lost because it was facing a very determined and unified ruling class that was using the Labour Party to batter down the resistance, and then the Tories come in and do their traditional job of cleaning up the ground that's been prepared for them by the Labour Party. Any other questions? Yes, Conrad.
How do you think that's going to affect affairs? So they seem to be so badly misjudged their own capacity.
Well, it's a strange thing. I mean, I say they were slightly smarter back then, the British ruling class were. I think they were made to be smarter in a way, because the previous generations had to deal with much stronger socialist states. They had to reckon with the power of the Soviet Union, both in industrial terms and military terms. It forces the leadership of the American ruling class to be, to a certain extent, better than they would have been otherwise. So, like, you get a Nixon and you get a Kissinger, for example, revolting criminals on many levels, but certainly not stupid men. What's happened now is that they have two curses fundamentally crippling their abilities here. One is that they have fundamentally misinterpreted what happened in 1989 to 91. They saw a collapse of the enemy system, and they thought it was their victory. My argument is it wasn't their victory, it was our defeat. It was a defeat of the working class internationally. More specifically, it was a defeat by counter-revolutionaries of the Soviet system and the people's democracies. That collapsed due to massive internal contradictions, which if I started talking about now, we'd need until tomorrow to clear up. But the US ruling class looked at that and thought, we've won, and we've won because our system is superior. You hear them talk about it constantly in the literature at the time, saying, we have won, the free market system has proven itself to be infinitely more flexible than the rigid command economy. Whereas in actual fact, what was happening was that, and this is an argument made by Marxist economists of various different shades, including the likes of Michael Hudson makes this argument in his own way, various others do as well, that the crisis of the 1960s, the crisis of profitability that hit US capitalism back then, wasn't actually recovered from. It was papered over by the emergence of the dollar as the global reserve currency, forcing everybody to buy dollars through the petrodollar system. And so they and the extension of credit whilst attacking the working class at the same time to essentially give the illusion of prosperity through the 80s. So when they hit 91, 92, they think not only have we won, we've secured ourselves for decades to come. No one can challenge us. And so they fundamentally misinterpreted what was a defeat for their enemy as a victory for them. It's the difference between winning a boxing match and having the opposition manager throw the towel in for you and declaring it a victory. Essentially, that's what happened. And so and then they chose to fight a series of enemies in the form of Milosevic in Yugoslavia, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, the Taliban, even though they lost that one, that enabled them to think that not only can we win, we don't even have to use our own people to win. Through our complete control of the global financial system, we can exert sanctions on anybody. Through our domination of global culture, and the image of the United States, we can help to build networks to run what now referred to as color revolutions anywhere. And this combination of overconfidence, misinterpretation of their own history, and a reliance increasingly on essentially automated and electronic systems in terms of their ability to cut countries off from the SWIFT system, impose sanctions at the click of a mouse button, all made them think that, well, we can do anything now. And we don't even have to take the risk of actually having a US soldier come back in an American flag wrapped coffin anymore. They thought, when looking at Russia, well, this is a corrupt state that's tied into our global system. If we hit the Putin government hard enough, there'll be a revolt of the oligarchs who won't want to lose their ability to park their money in the British Virgin Islands anymore and buy up property in London and New York and Paris. And had this been 2007, they might have been right. What they failed to take into account, though, was that because they've been throwing these sanctions at everybody who displeased them over the last 20 years, that at least a section of the Russian state had been smart enough to study these processes and to work out ways around it. Hence why that since 2008 and the Georgia War, the Russians were slowly pivoting their trade more and more towards the east in order to find workarounds. And so by the time they came to launch the special military operation in 2022, they'd got enough workarounds in place with the Chinese and others and built up enough diplomatic support that when the Americans and the Europeans hit them with the sanctions packages, it didn't work, or at least it didn't work in the way that they thought it would. So to conclude and answer your question, it's a combination of a bad reading of history, a bad reading of their own history. They don't understand, the current administrators of their own system don't fully understand it, and they don't understand why this system was the product of a crisis of the older system, which forced them to abandon the gold standard. And so when you've had actually 60 plus years long crisis in both Britain and the United States, which they've been papering over and papering over. In actual fact, one of the worst things that could have happened to them was the collapse of the Soviet Union in some ways, because all it did was convince them that they didn't need to change anything. And also then you go back to the fundamental Marxist principles and look at what imperialism does. Imperialism, because it's based on a crisis of profitability and an inability to make as much money as you used to be able to by employing domestic labor, you then move to the export of capital, and that not only forces you to rely more and more upon exploiting foreign countries, but also it hollows out your own country until we're all just coupon clippers looking for a return on a share. And that has an impact in terms of the cohesiveness of societies, the ability of the US to and Britain to actually do domestic projects anymore. And so it hollowed out their own societies. They made horrible misjudgments about their abilities to project their power. They made terrible and disastrous judgments about the way that the Russian economy and state was structured. They relied upon intelligence assessments from like their pet oligarchs who now live in the West, who were exiled by Putin due to the fact they couldn't abide by some simple rules, who tell them, oh yeah, yeah, that, just put some sanctions on, it'll all fall apart. They even formed a Russian government in exile consisting of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and some other losers who sit in apparently in Vilnius scheming. So it's a combination of all those things, but ultimately it comes down to the long-term hollowing out process that imperialism will do to any country. And that's at the root of what I think you're getting at there. Any further questions or contributions anybody wants to make? Yes. Well, that's a nice and spicy one. My own personal view on Scottish independence, when it comes to the what I'll call a petty bourgeois nationalist movement in the form of the SNP, it's based on a lot of historical fictions. Scotland and the Scottish ruling class 300 years ago were the co-founders of British imperialism with the English ruling class. They did a deal together to bring themselves together so that they could better exploit the world, rather than have failed colonial experiments like the Scottish did in Panama. So when you're looking at Scotland, you're looking at a ruling class that merged with the English ruling class to create the British ruling class. There's areas of Scotland that are very poor. There's areas of Scotland there the working class has been condemned to extreme poverty. But there's areas of England like that as well. My argument is about Scottish independence that this is the obsession of a petty bourgeois leftist layer that isn't really serious about it, because fundamentally they didn't even want to do the most limited type of program. They wanted to keep the pound as a currency. They wanted to stay in NATO. They weren't going to ask the British even to withdraw the military bases from there. So the question I always ask is, well, first of all, what is it for? Second of all, like, what does setting up this new state do in terms of the class struggle on a nationwide basis? Like it or not, we are one economic unit in Britain. If our fight is for socialism in that country, then we will be fighting for the establishment of a democratically planned economy across the whole country, all of the free countries that currently compose Britain. So whereas like we would support the separation of the occupied six counties in the north of Ireland, our planning for the future and the struggle for a socialist system means that, yeah, in the future, under workers' rule, we might have like a federation of England, Scotland or Wales. But I don't see what independence for Wales and Scotland on a capitalist basis right now actually does for workers in those countries and the combined struggle we would need to wage to get rid of the British ruling class. I don't see this anything as other than a distraction, basically. And the politics of it have always revealed themselves to be very impotent when tried to be put to the test, rather bluntly. Yes. Well, it's a good question, and that's why I said that multipolarity is a stage. It's not the answer. So you can see in some of the countries in West Africa that the local leadership, of course, wants to assert a certain degree of national independence more. But as I said, also, that just opens up new avenues of struggle. It opens up another struggle, because rather than being suppressed by the US imperialists, as your question implies, yes, they're now being, they'll be more directly suppressed by a local ruling class. So it solves one contradiction, and it opens up a load more, to answer your question. And hopefully that with the departure of the American unipolar system, it actually will enable greater class struggles in those countries against the localized local ruling classes. Because a lot of these ruling classes, even once they're freed from American domination, aren't going to get much better in terms of being less parasitic and less dependent upon outside investors. And so it will hopefully encourage greater class struggle, not less of it. I'm not one of those who thinks that once Pax Americana is gone, then that's everything closed down. No, it will merely be another stage in the development of class struggles. Anybody got anything further, or should we draw down?
Yeah, I think we can finish here.
Okay. Thanks very much.